Today on Maine Calling, what to know about psilocybin, the chemical found in magic mushrooms. It's not just long-haired hippies using magic mushrooms these days. Users include stressed-out moms, trendy 20-somethings, and cancer patients. Studies show that the use of psilocybin is on the rise in America and has been since about 2019. In a handful of places, psilocybin is now decriminalized, including Oregon and Colorado. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss why attitudes seem to be changing about this hallucinogen and what its potential might be. Some medical researchers see it as a treatment for ailments, including depression. Others warn about dangers and unknowns. What might psilocybin use look like in the future, in medicine and recreationally? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we're learning about the effects of the psychedelic drug psilocybin on the brain. What are researchers finding about the pros and cons of using this substance to treat certain medical conditions? And what is happening with the efforts to decriminalize it in Maine? Joining me for this hour, Dr. Robert Gramling, who is a professor and vice chair of research for family medicine at the University of Vermont Medical Center. He specializes in palliative medicine and has been involved with psilocybin research. We invite you to join the conversation. What have you heard about psilocybin, also known as magic mushrooms? Share your comments and questions. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Gramling, thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't we start with a very basic question? How do you pronounce the word? Do you pronounce it psilocybin or psilocybin?
Thank you, Jen. Psilocybin is how I say it. I can't be an authority on the linguistics, though.
Okay, so let's start with the big question. You know, if you encounter people who are advocates of psilocybin use, you would think it's absolutely amazing, almost magical in what it can do for people. Cure headaches and depression, profoundly change one's outlook on life. Is this all true?
So one of my roles, Jen, is I'm a palliative care physician. I'm an epidemiologist. And as a scientist, I bring, I guess, the humility to this field about trying to understand what psilocybin and other forms of healing can do for people, particularly those who are experiencing suffering or existential loneliness, just loss of connection with others. And I entered this field, I've primarily been studying conversations in palliative care and other settings, but about 3 years ago, I decided to do a year-long certificate program to understand more about it. Because many of my colleagues in palliative care science world have been paying close attention because of the exact types of things you're pointing to. The testimonials from people, clinical trial evidence is beginning to demonstrate that for some subsection of our population experiencing types of suffering, that this approach to therapy can have profound and durable effects, even from one episode of psychedelic assisted therapy. So I'm quite intrigued, and I look forward to contributing to the science in a way that we can really evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of this.
I noticed you said that very carefully. For some subsection of our population, it sounds like you're not advocating that everyone begin microdosing.
Well, maybe I'll separate out two things. My experience as a researcher has been in the high dose or the typical dose for many of the clinical trials, which is separate from microdosing, which microdosing typically is referred to as doses of magic mushrooms or psilocybin that people are not aware of the consciousness effects while they're taking them. the stuff I'm referring to is in the psychedelic assisted therapy around high dose, usually about 0.3 milligrams per kilogram, where people do recognize they are experiencing an expanded state of consciousness.
Mm. Well, tell us about the research you've done. I understand that you are one of those doctors who have guided people through this experience. Is that correct? And then tell me about what it's like. What does that entail?
So, yeah, so I'm a apprentice therapist at the Bill Richards Center for Healing down at Sunstone Therapies in Maryland, who this is, I believe, one of the premier organizations running clinical trials, where I spent a sabbatical time to develop the experience of being with, as a clinician, with people who are experiencing psilocybin. As a researcher here in Vermont, what we have been studying is the therapeutic alliance. What do conversations in human connection look like during the therapy of psychedelic assisted therapy? And we have been using clinical trial evidence with data sharing agreements from other sites that have the FDA and DEA approval to run those trials.
Mm. And what have you found so far?
So far, both my experience sitting as an apprentice therapist and with research is that the human relationship, the human connection, the therapy part of the psychedelic assisted therapy is profound. I think we understand little now about how much is the substance and how much is the relationship. But what I can tell you is, from my experience, is the relationship really does matter, and how the therapy is offered in its setting, in the safety and the readiness to be a supportive person for someone experiencing psilocybin is crucially important.
Mm. Tell us how it works. What does psilocybin do to your brain, magic mushrooms? Why is it that it creates a hallucinogenic experience?
I'll try not to answer too many of your questions with an I don't know, but in reality, Jen, I think I don't know many of these things, and I'll say that with both integrity and humility. But one of the things we do understand about the classic psychedelics is they affect the serotonin system in the brain. And why that creates the imagery, the experience of expanded consciousness, the sense of what some have referred to as a mystical experience, I don't think we understand enough of the neurobiology to point to that specifically, and I certainly don't.
Is it, I would imagine that it's uncomfortable as a physician and somebody who studies science to guide somebody through something that you don't really understand why it's doing what it's doing.
I think yes and no. As a palliative care physician, I think as a discipline, we find ourselves amid uncertainty in profound sorts of ways, is what the human experience and what suffering means to people. And I have become comfortable in helping to navigate that both as a person and as a clinician of how I interact with people. I do think we understand enough of the effects of the classic psychedelics to have some understanding of what we would anticipate for the impact on people's consciousness trajectory. So even if I don't understand which neurons specifically are being affected in the brain and how, I do think we have enough scientific understanding of the impact of that over the 5 to 8 hour period to be able to show up as a clinician and be ready for both safety and partnering with people during that experience.
Mm. We've been using the word psilocybin and magic mushrooms a little bit interchangeably. When you are working with a patient, are you giving them a mushroom? What are you giving them?
Where I have been an apprentice therapist, it's with clinical trials where they have a standardized dose of the psilocybin in a pill form. So it's not in the dried mushroom form, which has a variable amount of psilocybin in them, because there are many species of mushroom that produce psilocybin, and how much and how you standardize that dose becomes very important for clinical trials, because we're trying to offer a scientific understanding for our regulatory bodies to guide us on legalizing if that's the way the science goes.
You know, you're talking about when you're in this 5 to 8 hour experience being with someone to make sure they are safe. What would be unsafe? What happens?
So one of the common things I have been trained, and some of my mentors have really helped me learn, is that my job as a as a person, being present with someone who's receiving psilocybin, is to offer what we might call interpersonal grounding. And one of my mentors, Bill Richards, describes this as the quality of the human relationship that enables the person who has received the psychedelic to feel safe, open, curious, and courageous as the opportunities to explore the human mind open up. And I say that because I think the word safety, there's going to be physical safety of what these substances can do to one's body and one's experience, and I can speak to that in a second as well. And then there's also going to the spiritual and emotional safety and experience during the psilocybin dosing day. And many of the experiences people will have may be scary. They may be beautiful, they may be scary, they may be both. But part of what the Therapeutic Alliance offers is the ability for the person to trust in themselves and their own healing abilities, to explore further into that experience, to dive into it, find what you can learn. And so that's the term courage that Bill refers to in this definition. And so when you refer to some of the things I can offer for people's safety and experience, it may be the person knowing that I have their back while they are going to do what they need to do to heal.
On the line with us now is CJ Spotswood, who is a nurse practitioner, educator, and author. He specializes in psychiatric mental health and psychedelic use in medicine. Thanks for calling in, CJ.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you're here in Maine, correct?
Such an important topic. I am.
Okay, great. And I'm wondering how you became interested in the effects of these drugs like psilocybin as a medical professional.
I got into it, really. I had a patient come in, this was years ago, into my ER when I was working there, having they were acutely psychotic, and about 3 days after treating them, they started coming out of it, and they had mentioned that they were using mushrooms to help treat their mental health, and this was before Michael Pollan's book came out, and I just started diving into the research and trying to figure out more about what were they trying to achieve, and here we are now learning more, seeing more, and it's just been a fascinating experience.
I understand that you've written a book about microdosing. We talked about that just a little tiny bit a few minutes ago. What is the difference between microdosing and other uses of magic mushrooms, and what do you see as the benefits of it?
Microdosing is taking like 1/20th to 1/10th of a full amount. So it's a non-psychoactive, you're not going on the experience, you're not having a psychedelic trip, and you can kind of go on with your day as you would with any other medication without having that altered state to it. And with that, it offers for people who may not want to have a full experience or cannot mentally handle going into a full experience, some of the benefits of what these mushrooms and other psychedelic substances do offer.
Yeah. So tell me about potential harms or side effects or precautions even that you would offer about the use of psilocybin, even microdosing.
Well, the first thing I always mention, the biggest side effect out there, is the legal ramifications if caught. I ended up testifying for a nurse in Indiana 2 years ago who was caught growing mushrooms and ended up getting arrested, and the amount that she had was enough that they were looking at for trafficking, even though it was for personal use. And she's been fighting since then, and just last month was granted getting her license back with treatment, because she's explored and tried every other standard treatment option out there. Other side effects that worry about is potentially just like standard medication like SSRIs, potentially leading on to a manic type episode that someone might have. So I always encourage people to, you know, have another person kind of working with them and kind of observing their mood. And if it starts getting too high or these manic type states, to kind of maybe work with them and understand that, because we're not exactly the best judgment of our own mental state sometimes, especially when someone is depressed for so long and they start feeling better, then it could be up there elevated.
CJ, before we let you go, I want to ask you about the stigma associated with using psychedelic drugs. I think a lot of people have an idea in their mind's eye of people who might use them, and it's not a positive one. What would you say to that?
I think the hard part is there's so many people who haven't come out of what we refer to as the psychedelic closet, and letting people know that these are substances that they've found beneficial and helpful in their lives. So the stigma kind of continues. And the more that we talk about it, the more that we are aware of it, having great platforms such as this, where we can come out and people can kind of see what's going on. They can see that there's more use out there, and there's more people. I mean, when I do my talks at conferences, I think of like the first time I ever did one, as I'm mentioning to a bunch of nurses, substance use nurses, mental health nurses, I was talking about the positive effects throughout the years. And I had a group of older nurses near retirement or retired who were just shaking their head. And afterward, they came up to me and go, yeah, we've known these things since the 60s. And we're just kind of coming back around. And it's one of those things where, you know, as people become more aware of it and seeing some more of the research out there, more people are talking about it, we end up seeing that it isn't such a scary, radical idea that people might be able to use these substances to have personal improvement.
Well, CJ, thank you so much for calling in. CJ Spotswood, a nurse practitioner and author of the book, The Microdosing Guidebook About Psychedelic Medicine. I'm going to try to go to a call before our break. I'll go to Annie calling from Kittery. Hi, Annie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Sorry, I just took it off speaker. I just wanted to say, I graduated high school in 2010, and then I graduated UNH in 2014 studying health management and policy. Didn't really even have any exposure to any drugs other than marijuana until after college. But especially my generation, unfortunately, a handful of people have overdosed in my graduating high school class, and all these people got addicted to hard drugs through being prescribed it through childhood. And I've witnessed firsthand, a lot of my friends have, you know, taken a mushroom bar and completely lost their craving for hard drugs, whether that be, you know, heroin or fentanyl or cocaine. And I think it's amazing the opportunity for people to be able to access it. And I love that you brought up psychological safety, because I think that's so important. When people are taking these trips, it's so grounding back to their true essence, not to sound too corny, but the fact that, you know, it's grown from the earth, I think it's a great thing to ground people. And I do think maybe a huge threat is the threat to the pharmaceutical industry. Once these become legal, people will no longer need or potentially need to be addicted to Suboxone or, you know, ADHD.
Yeah, Annie, thank you so much for your perspective. And I want to turn to Dr. Gramling and ask about that. You know, we haven't really talked about, we've talked about headaches and depression, but what about as something to help people who are addicted to really dangerous drugs?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Annie, and also and CJ for hearing your ideas is gratefully helpful. The three general areas that the classic psychedelics have been having the most evidence of benefit over harm has been in depression and anxiety and existential well-being, particularly in serious illness and end of life, which is my area of interest, but also in people experiencing and re-experiencing traumatic experiences in their life and with substance use disorders of several kinds. And so Annie really points to one very important area of research that has a lot of promising use and really harkens back to the late 40s and 50s when even LSD was used in the substance use disorder for alcohol and prior to the Controlled Substance Act of the late 60s. And so there's a long, rich history of this. And I also just want to mention, you know, we're talking about this in kind of the biomedicalization for the regulatory and the science of this, which is part of the world I am studying this in. I want to acknowledge that we're learning from millennia from indigenous cultures around the world that have used these substances very effectively in ceremonial and healing ways, and grateful for their teachings and including in the area of spiritual well-being and other substances that can be more harmful.
Annie, thank you for your call. We are going to take a quick break. We are talking about psilocybin, also known as magic mushrooms, here on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Psilocybin use is on the rise, recreationally and also in medical research, as potential treatment for many things, including headaches and depression. We're learning about that today, and we're learning about efforts to decriminalize this psychedelic drug here in Maine. My guest, Dr. Bob Gramling with the University of Vermont Medical Center, who is professor and vice chair of research in family medicine. He specializes in palliative care. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about psychedelic drug use and its potential benefits or harms? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, or post a comment in Maine Calling's Facebook or Instagram. Calling in now is State Representative Grayson Luckner, who is a Democrat from Portland. Representative, I understand you have introduced a bill that would decriminalize some use of psilocybin. What would this bill do?
Hey, Jennifer, thanks for having me on the call. Yeah, first of all, I mean, among all these super important issues facing our state, from, you know, like housing and climate change and all the things that are affecting us on a daily basis, I thought that this bill was worth introducing because of a lot of the research that shows its effectiveness in treating things like PTSD and palliative care, as we've heard before. So this bill is really simple. It just proposes to decriminalize small amounts, therapeutic amounts for adults over the age of 21.
All right. And I know the other states, Oregon and Colorado, have already decriminalized psilocybin. What have we learned from those states about what might work and might not work as far as a bill, a law in Maine?
Sure. Both of those efforts went through a referendum, which seems to be sometimes the more effective way of getting big things done. And they both set up a therapeutic framework. We've had efforts to do similar things legislatively in previous sessions. In this session, instead of setting up sort of a therapeutic framework, I thought, well, it's just, you know, the stuff grows in the ground. It's naturally occurring. It's been here in Maine for thousands of years. Why don't we just let adults, if they want to possess it? It's rarely charged as a crime. So it just seemed silly to, you know, still have it as a crime on the books.
And what would you say, Representative, to people who say, you know what, do we really want to be making more and more drugs legal? Would this open up people to, you know, open up society to more substance use? And also, would it be difficult to enforce?
Well, first of all, I think it's already difficult to enforce. And secondly, we're using the tools of the criminal justice system, policing and prisons, to really treat problems of mental illness when they should be kept out of those systems, and just sort of they exasperate crises that people are already experiencing. So I think what we're doing now is ineffective. As far as, you know, the safety profile, like, you know, alcohol is so much more dangerous as a drug than psilocybin. So, you know, this is just about letting responsible adults have some say. And again, like, this bill, charging people criminally for possessing psilocybin is just, it's so rarely used in the state anyway. So I'm not saying we need to encourage the use of psilocybin. It's just about allowing people who want to avail themselves of this medication the ability to do so.
Well, Representative Grayson Luckner, thanks so much for calling in and telling us about your bill. Grayson Luckner serves in the Maine House of Representatives. And we're going to turn now to Sheriff Kevin Joyce with the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office. He is the scholarly communication. Oh, hold on just a second. I'm reading the wrong thing. Sheriff Joyce, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Jennifer.
You just heard Representative Luckner. What do you think of this legislation, proposed legislation?
I can tell you the Maine sheriffs, including myself, are against this. You know, I've heard that, well, okay, this is this the psilocybin is just like alcohol. I don't think so in some of the training I've had in the past, as well as research. You've got individuals that using a hallucinogen, which psilocybin is, and they do have a lot of commonality with other drugs, including alcohol. But one of the stark differences that I've been aware of is when I was a drug recognition expert, we learned of people using hallucinogens and jumping off parking garages because they thought they could fly. You know, using hallucinogens, one of the concerns is what happens afterwards. If the psilocybin is strong enough, people can have bad trips. They can have flashbacks after the use of it. You know, I've heard people talk about, well, it's a legitimate drug. Well, so isn't fentanyl. Fentanyl is a legitimate pharmaceutical medication, but we're seeing the fallout of that, OxyContin. And then lastly, I heard that, well, psilocybin is not a big deal in Maine. Well, we are making arrests. It's not a lot of arrests, just like up until recently, methamphetamine was here and there, but not, you know, here as a mainstay. And now we're starting to see methamphetamine coming into Portland as a mainstay and trying to figure out what we're going to do about it. So this really goes back to medical marijuana and how that was, and, you know, it's going to save the world, if you will. Before you know it, it's recreational. So law enforcement is pretty much against this. There's no regulation on it whatsoever.
It seems to me, Sheriff Joyce, that you're saying, you know, it sounds like people are pretty nonchalant, being pretty nonchalant about something that, in your view, is very serious.
Well, we end up dealing with all of the issues, whether it's somebody using this medication or drug and then getting behind the wheel of a vehicle, whether or not somebody using this drug decides that they can, you know, they're hallucinating and they can fly and they jump off. Yeah, we end up being the end result of individuals using this. And honestly, we believe that this relaxing of any drugs going forward is just dumbing down society and creating issues that law enforcement is going to have to deal with, EMS is going to have to deal with. And it's concerning that we have a nonchalant attitude about these medications and drugs.
Yeah, before we let you go, Sheriff Joyce, anything you'd like to add about this, either the bill or just what your experience with people who have used psilocybin?
Well, you know, I can't speak to the clinical or therapeutic benefits, but, you know, one thing that I always tell people is it needs to have FDA approval, CDC approval, DEA approval. I like to get my medications from a person wearing a white coat and not necessarily blue jeans. So, you know, if we're going to look at that, then the pharmaceuticals ought to be coming from a pharmacy and not a farm.
Sheriff Joyce, thank you so much for calling. That was Cumberland County Sheriff Kevin Joyce. And I'll turn back to you, Dr. Gramling, about what's going on here in Maine legislatively. But you heard the concerns of the sheriff that people jumping off of parking garages. Do you think that that is a real and legitimate concern?
Oh, I think any of our first responders, you know, who are responding to a tragedy like that is horrific, regardless of the cause. And I certainly am not here to defend, you know, psychedelics in any way, with respect to their impact on expanded states of consciousness. What I do think that I was part of the advisory board for Vermont, who is considering legalizing psilocybin, and so we provided a report to our legislature, and we grapple with a lot of these same issues. Is on one hand what the criminalization of this has done to parts of our society, and what the potential therapeutic benefits can be. And one of the things that we found as a group is plenty of differences of opinion and plenty of emotion around them, which is, as human beings, that's important for us to be aware of, and that a lot of the evidence that's coming through is pretty consistent. The meta-analyses, the systematic reviews, all point to there being a therapeutic role for classic psychedelics in different forms of suffering. What we don't know enough is how best to do that, particularly at the population level, and how to support people. And so one of the things I personally feel is critically important is that we find ways towards allowing healthcare practitioners to understand how to integrate this into a safe environment within which we have the expertise. Everything I do as a physician has risks and benefits, regardless of the substance. And I'm trained to understand the science about when and how to apply those things to benefit the person in front of me. That's the science that we really, really need to cultivate, because I think these are powerful and potentially very healing substances, and we need to understand the therapy part of it better.
And it sounds like we hear about the idea of it being becoming something in mainstream medicine from two different perspectives here, whereas Sheriff Joyce is saying, I want something with CDC and FDA approval. I want somebody in a white coat to be giving it to me, not somebody in blue jeans. Yet we heard Grayson Luckner say there are people who believe that this is going to be, something the pharmaceutical industry doesn't like because they're not able to make money off of it. And so people who are skeptical of the pharmaceutical industry and its its intentions and its reasons for bringing something to market, and others who say, you know what, I like the medical establishment and that's where I want to get my psilocybin. That's part of the bigger conversation here.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the medical establishment hasn't always worked well for everybody as well, and we need to acknowledge that and we need to improve upon it. So as we study these therapies, we need to understand that there's going to be a diversity of ways in which this is going to help people. And there's going to be important considerations for us to be aware of about where the harms can be. And so that we can help advise people and help choose to use or not use these substances in a guided sort of way that the person themselves can help understand the risks and benefits to themselves.
I'm going to go to an email here from someone who does not want us to use his name. He writes, my brother has suffered from cluster headaches for over 25 years. About 15 years ago, he started taking a small dose of psilocybin, lower than what was required for a psychedelic effect, to get them to stop. One dose keeps them away for 6 months. There is nothing else that works for him and many other people he knows from online support groups. Cluster headaches are also known as suicide headaches due to their nature. Psilocybin can literally be a lifesaver, and you are talking, Dr. Gramling, about a lot of these anecdotal stories that you and others who study this are hearing.
Indeed, and I'm so grateful to hear that your brother is doing well with such a big source of suffering for people. Even in the clinical trials where we were recording outcomes in a systematic sort of way, two recent ones at Johns Hopkins and at NYU observed that 6 months after receiving a single dose of psilocybin within about a 3-week context of therapy was associated with 8 out of 10 people had improvement in general well-being and with life satisfaction. And these are among people with serious illnesses in cancer in particular. But these profound, durable, long-term effects are part of the reason that many of us are quite intrigued about when and how these can be applied, whether to cluster headaches or to depression, anxiety, or loneliness, or whatever the source of suffering may be for people.
We'll go to Joyce, who's calling from Vermont. Hi, Joyce, go ahead.
I'm a naturopathic physician, and the use of classical homeopathy has been an important part of my practice, classical homeopathy, using a wide variety of psychotropic natural substances, has been used for 250 years with safety and efficacy. And it's safe, and it doesn't micromanage the biochemistry of the body. It helps to enhance the natural healing ability of the body. And what you see with even cannabis, there's a lot of questions about the long-term safety of cannabis. Classical homeopathic preparations of all these psychotropic substances, including peyote and cannabis, is safer and much more effective long-term.
So, Joyce, it sounds to me as though you are advocating the allowance of their use, but all only under the care of a homeopathic doctor or another healthcare professional.
No, people don't understand that herbal preparations are totally different than classical homeopathy. Classical homeopathy is totally energetic. They're originally made from psychotropic plant material, and I'm a botanist, including mushrooms of all types, psychotropic mushrooms, but there's no molecules of material substance left. So it's totally different, and healthcare practitioners of all kinds do not understand this.
I see.
Totally energetic medicine.
Thank you, Joyce. And Dr. Gramley, I want to turn to you because we've been talking about psilocybin, magic mushrooms, and but there are many, many other mushrooms out there. And to Joyce's thoughts about them working differently on your system than traditional medicine, what are your thoughts?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Joyce, and for your advocacy and your presence with people. So I'm not a botanist like Joyce is, and won't be able to speak to the different species of mushroom and what they contain. What I can point to that I, you know, the more I have my career progresses and I experience therapy with different people, is that the relationship and the way that we show up makes a profound difference. And some of that are in ways that we don't yet understand and may show up differently, whether it's in homeopathy or with a mystical experience taking a psychedelic, that there's something about the way that we connect with other human beings amid these therapies that is quite powerful and may manifest in similar sorts of ways across a variety of substances. And I'd wonder about that a little bit with Joyce and her experience.
All right. Well, I do need to take another quick break. Dr. Joyce, thank you so much for calling in. We're talking about psilocybin on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, psilocybin, which is also known commonly by the nicknames of shrooms or magic mushrooms. Why has this psychedelic drug grown in popularity recently? What are its potential benefits and harms? And why is the medical community interested in its effects? Joining me for the hour, Dr. Bob Gramling with the University of Vermont's Medical Center. He is a family practice physician, professor, and researcher who studies psilocybin. If you're quick, you can share your comments and questions. We have an email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also call 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Jonathan Levitt from Maine Fungi Fest. Jonathan, I understand that's in its fourth year and coming up pretty soon.
Okay. Yeah, the event is in its fourth year. And this year, it's being held over at Sebago Lake at St. Joseph College from May 30th through June 1st. And it's got quite a lineup of workshops, presentations, panel discussions, keynote presenters, vendors, performers, demonstrations, all things kind of focused around three themes, which are all things fungi, plant-based healing, and evolving consciousness.
So, Jonathan, I want to ask you, I've read surveys that say since about 2019, interest in psilocybin and magic mushrooms has grown. Are you seeing that in your 4 years of holding the Fungi Fest? Have you seen growth in the interest?
Yeah, definitely a more public presence of the conversations. People are, as they did in cannabis, you know, they people are kind of having a public recognition of it as a real substantial conversation needs to be had, and people are feel safer being public about their utilization of it or their cultivation of it. There is a significant underground community in Maine currently right now that's providing, that's utilizing psilocybin, that's utilizing, MDMA, ketamine, all these different kinds of medicines and healing possibilities. And they're doing it, you know, regardless of what folks like Sheriff, the sheriff you had on previously, you know, despite their unwillingness to kind of really be truthful about the whole question of how we utilize and how we integrate different ways of healing into their framework for living, which is, you know, control and command. You know, psychedelics are new possibilities. They're a new conversation. And we should be proud about having that conversation right now. And yeah, certainly in Maine, it's much more public conversation than 2019.
Yeah, well, Jonathan, thank you so much for calling in. Jonathan Levitt organizes and runs the Maine Fungi Fest, which is coming up at the end of the month, as he said, at St. Joseph's College. Dr. Grambling, I'm looking at the calls and emails coming in. So many people taking issue, as we just heard with Sheriff Joyce's concerns about magic mushrooms, somebody calling this thing about somebody jumping off a parking garage a trope. Have you seen people, when you are guiding people through the experience, in a state where they may do something to harm themselves? Are Sheriff Joyce's concerns, in your view, legitimate?
Thanks, Jen. So, you know, I grew up as a teenager in the 80s, so I have in my mind the, you know, the experiences of, you know, your brain on drugs in a frying pan, and the stories as well. And I think the stories have some truth to them. There are experiences that people have had from a variety of reasons. What I think is critically important for this conversation, as really I've mentioned before, is I think we need to understand this systematically. I think we really need to engage in high quality science to understand how frequent are these events. I think they're very infrequent. And to answer your question, no, when the people who I've been sitting with have had hard experiences. But interestingly, some of the trials that I've been part of are placebo controlled, and I'm not so sure that the person received the active ingredient or not, that the relationship itself and the ability to go in and really explore the human mind is enough of a mystery that having the support there can be critically important. And so absolutely, I think that you need to think about safety very purposefully when you're doing any type of medication that may impact your normal cognitive functioning. We think of all of those things in the setting that we offer them in clinical environments, including the fact that people are staying in the room where we're offering this, and that they won't be alone, and that we have talked ahead of time and rehearsed what are all the things that if you're feeling impulsive to want to do something, how are we going to interact in a way together that's going to feel safe to you and allow me to watch out for your safety. Having said that, none of those have happened, even though we talk about them and prepare. So I do worry a little bit that if we get into advocacy too much one way or another, we will all kind of hang our narrative on the profound outliers of experience. And where we really need to understand is, from a population perspective, is what's the epidemiology of this and how do we do it and in whom and when, rather than whether. Or I guess
we'll
whether
go,
too. That's
yeah, we'll go to Rick, who's calling from Tremont. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking the call. A very excellent session here. Lots of information. I had a stroke several years ago, which I survived, thank goodness. And I've had a lot of issues on my left side with spasticity and pain. And I have had two psilocybin sessions, taken not heroic doses, but large doses. No psychedelic experience, but I found that my pain level with the spasticity dropped considerably after the experience, and that it was very, very helpful.
Rick, thank you for calling with your experience. Dr. Grambling, talking about a stroke survivor, is this something that you've heard about and is being studied?
I'm grateful that your pain is better. It is beautiful, and no, the answer to your question is no. I'm not aware of clinical trials specific for post-stroke experience. I don't discount the experience, however, and that many serious illnesses are going to present different types of kind of whole person pain in addition to the physical pain that people have. And I think that these types of experiences and therapies can be of potential benefit to all of that. And we need to better understand and how.
Rick, thank you. Let's see, we'll move on. We'll go up to Gray and Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great, go ahead.
I'm calling because I am a 45-year-old daughter of an immigrant. I am a mother to two daughters, ages 20 and 14. And I recently went on a high-dose guided psilocybin trip. I'm a person who has suffered from depression the majority of my life, including suicidal thoughts and attempts. And I can say that after I had my session, I have not suffered with that at all since then. And I've been through every type of therapy. There is dialectical behavioral therapy, you name it. You know, I've tried antidepressants, whatnot, and it's been beyond life-changing.
Lisa, did you say, and maybe I missed it, did you say how long ago you did this?
This was in November.
Wow.
November is last year, yeah. And I've had my follow-up visits. My primary care physician is aware that I went through this. I've been working with them as well, you know, keeping an eye on my depression levels, see how it is, because he knew me before and after, and same with my therapist. And it has been quite life-changing. And I know multiple police officers who have done this, and I know multiple service people who have done this as well, especially those suffering from PTSD, that has made significant impacts on their lives. And I think it's a wonderful thing.
Lisa, I'm so glad to hear that you're not feeling that pain. Dr. Gramling, go ahead.
Lisa, thank you for calling in. I'm so grateful for your experience. And I think what Lisa's describing is some of the profound experiences that led me and many of my colleagues to try to understand this better, both to train ourselves into the current sciences and how to engage in how do we do this and for whom. And, you know, this may not be Lisa's experience, but some of the pieces to this experience that I've heard from many people is whatever the source of suffering that people had before, it can feel extraordinarily isolating and people can feel alone, kind of very deeply existentially lonely. And these experiences with classical psychedelics oftentimes lead people to just kind of feel that they're not alone, however you would define such a thing. And then that lasts with people durably, oftentimes for as long as we've been following them in follow-up studies. So that may not be the mechanism of action for why this helps certain people, but it's a pretty profound experience of the feeling deeply in your bones that I'm not alone.
Interesting you said that, because I wanted to ask you, Dr. Gramling, if for some people, perhaps for Lisa or for others, a one-time experience is enough.
Yeah, that's most of the science, particularly the psilocybin, is a three, usually 2 to 4 weeks of a therapy that has about 8 visits to it, 4 to 6 hours of preparation time, how we work together to define what is a safe environment for you and what are the intentions we bring to this and how is our relationship going to be healthy for you, and then the dosing day, and then 4 to 6 hours spread out over 2 to 3 weeks of what we call integration of what do I do with this? I've learned what I have learned. How do I bring this into my life? And that's one round of therapy, and most of the science in these clinical trials is for a one-time therapy.
Lisa, thank you so much for calling. I'm squeezing in one more question here. Fran on Facebook asks, how do you determine who might benefit from this treatment and who might not?
Is that a question for me? Beautiful.
Oh,
question.
Yes. So thank you. I don't know the answer.
I didn't know if you had another caller who was going to. So, you know, I think right now when we look at, when I've been pointing to these clinical trials, I'd like to also make sure that when we perform research, we recruit people and we screen them for things that we think may cause more harm than benefit. And I'll just name a few of them. And I'm not so sure we even know that these truly would cause more harm for people, but we watch them very carefully. People who have cardiac problems that might be prone to high heart rates or higher blood pressure being a problem for a short period of time, because that can happen with the psilocybin. People who have had a history of departures from reality that we might call psychotic, that have been dysfunctional for them, we don't know if this would make them worse or not. And so those and other things, we don't enroll people in the clinical trials yet with many of these disorders, knowing that we need to slowly expand the population as we do this to understand where indeed are the harms and how do we prevent them? Because we have to slowly get to answering that really, really profound question about how do we know who's going to get the most benefit and who's going to actually get the most harm from this? And so far, it's been quite impressive benefit to harm.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. That's Dr. Bob Gramling. He's from the University of Vermont Medical Center, a professor and a researcher in family medicine specializing in palliative care. Thank you so much. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to learn about the Shakers in Maine, their history and beliefs, and what to know about the Shaker Village in New Gloucester. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.